Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 11th, 2018, and welcome to episode 182 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and figuring out what to do with your old computers once you've collected them. I'm Earl Evans, your host with the most, and I am joined by a couple of our regular irregulars, Carrington Vanston and Paul Hagstrom. First, over to you, Paul. Let's hear how things are going for you, sir.
Well, things are going pretty well. Suddenly, it gets dark very early. I'm still not quite used to that. The time changed. But I can tell it's getting to be winter. And I've gotten past the beginning of November deadline, so that's one positive thing. I might have time to do other things. But anyway, all is well over on this coast.
Was it last year or the year before that that you had some significant snowfall come in?
Good question. I think
it was one of those years.
Occasionally there is significant snow. I usually block it out. So,
okay, well, yeah, that's good. Just kind of
it may have
forget about it.
I don't know. Sorry. I'm not helping this conversation along very well, but I really don't remember.
That's okay. Because I think Carrington said something about snow or something, didn't you?
It snowed yesterday. It's beginning to look a lot like it sucks. It's November. It's not even halfway through November, and it snowed in Toronto yesterday. Now, it stayed on the ground for one day. As of today, it's all gone again, so it was kind of like a shot across the bow from winter, saying, remember me? I do remember you, and I don't like you, winter. Anyway, it snowed yesterday. I'm grumpy about it. Boo to everything cold, said the Canadian. How ironic.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you do realize it gets kind of cold up there where you live, right?
I keep forgetting.
Well, so does Paul.
I'm warmed by my health care.
Oh, that's good. Touché, my friend. All right, moving along. I think we'll talk about a host topic. But before I do that, I reject my own host topic and talk about last time's topic. Because when you guys were going on about regrets, you know, what machine do you regret the most? Oh, do I ever have one? So this was the mid-90s, and I was anxious to get a machine that would run Windows 95. And I looked around. We all remember Computer Shopper. Wonderful magazine, super gigantic, you know, basically full of ads. Like a magazine that you buy and there's almost no content, there's just ads, and that was on purpose. So I used to look through there, seeing how I could piece together the best system that I could for the money. And I found this one shop in kind of a suburb of LA that did these mail order, and they were just always cheaper than everybody else. And these were the days before you could get internet reviews. So, you know, I chose my components carefully and I bought it from them and I got it, and it was a total piece of garbage. The case was awful. Basically, the video card got juggled loose in shipping. So when I got the machine and turned it on, it almost fried. I called them up and I said, hey, you guys should give me my money back. And they said no. And I said, well, I'm going to tell everybody that I know in the, you know, basically I've been in the computer industry for a long time. I'm going to tell everybody I know not to buy a computer from you guys. And they said, go for it. So I did. I mean, I would just insert it randomly in conversations with strangers and be like, oh, coffee's good. Well, hey, did you ever get a computer from XY Computers? Well, don't ever, because they suck. And man, I did that for years. In fact, my friends made fun of me for that.
Actually, now I understand a lot of your tweets. It makes no sense to me. Now I get it.
All you needed was context, right? So, anyway, that was my... Oh, I was so sad about it. Even when I finally retired that computer, I have a picture of me throwing it into the garbage. I actually took... And we had a little party, you know, danced around the bonfire of that computer. I hated its guts. But, you know, luckily that was a one-off. I mean, most of the time when I bought computers, whether they were retro or brand new or whatever, I've been very, very happy. So that was like a total 180. So that, you know, that's my story and you're stuck with it. So let me get on to the real host topic, unless you guys have any comments on that. No, good.
Nope.
Good. Let's move on. So, all right. You know, down with hate, on with like. So... let's talk about what you do with your retro computers. So one of the things that I found is, you know, I'm just tooling along and all of a sudden I've got some free time. Maybe I didn't even anticipate it. Plans changed or something. And now I'm looking at my retro computer or my collection and I'm kind of going, wow, there's 100 different things I could do here. I could write a little program. I could play Galaxian. I could connect it to the internet and try and tweet from it, which seems to be, you know, the thing to do these days. Or I could write a blog post about it, or I could go read a book about it. It's just, it's almost an overwhelming number of choices. And so you just get stuck and spin like, what am I going to do? And I don't think I'm the only one. And there's actually a blog that I'm going to talk about later when we get to the news thing section of the show that help you figure that out. But I was wondering, do you guys have that? Or if you don't, I'm even more interested if you don't. Like, when you get some free time and it's time to hobby, how do you guys figure out, like, what you're going to do next? Well, why don't we start with you, Carrington?
My dudes, I have come to tell you the good news of intentional living through minimalism. No, but seriously, I find it so hard. Like, the older I get... theoretically, I should have more time. I should be more in control of my life. But it seems like my hobby time just like shrivels up and goes away. It has mostly been solved for me because I always have all these things that I want to do. And when it comes to like retro computing things, it's mostly about old games I want to play. And a lot of times it's not like action games, it's adventure games and RPGs and things like that that would take, you know, dozens or 100 hours to play. And it's hard to set aside a dozen or 100 hours. Most recently, this was solved for me. Like, anyway, the idea is I'll have all these white whales, all these things I want to do. And usually the solution comes in somebody else saying, hey, why don't we do a thing together? Kevin asked me to hey, let's do a podcast. Let's play all the Infocom games and do a podcast. Suddenly, I have an excuse to do the Infocom games. And when I'm given like a podcast with a co-host, it's no longer, hey, I'm just frivolously making time to play an Infocom game. It's like, well, I have a commitment to, oh, darn, I have to play an Infocom game. And so like basically once a month, I ensure that I set aside that time. And without Kevin giving me that, like saying, let's play the game, let's make a podcast, I never would have played these things. I probably would have died having never played them because I always wanted to and for literally decades and I never got around to it. So for me, I always have that list of games I want to play, computers I want to tinker with, programs I want to write. And I so rarely take things off that list. I mostly just put things on that list. The fewer things I have, the less of a burden the things that I have are, in a sense. Like when I used to have more computers and more projects, they kind of made a background noise weighing on me of stuff I wanted to get to, but I never did. Mm-hmm. And so getting rid of things over the last 20 years really has freed up a lot of that, like kind of the burden of my goods. But honestly, the only solution that's worked for me is other people doing a thing and inviting me along. Like, it's just like, that's how I got on RCR. That's how I got to Eat My Gru. That's how I got a No Quarter. My life is other people who are more motivated than me, letting me tag along with them. And that's the only time I do anything worthwhile with my hobbies. So I appreciate and love you all. So thank you.
That's awesome. And it, you know, it's kind of like having a workout buddy, but rather than having a workout buddy to go do something that might be hard and unpleasant, you know, you have a workout buddy to do something that's fun. And I think that's a great idea.
In the same way that the best way to do a podcast is with a co-host, because you are obligated to kind of not let them down and you stick with a schedule and blah, blah, blah. It makes it way easier. Same thing with hobbies, like buddy up with somebody else who wants to do that hobby with you, and maybe you'll actually get it done. Like, so it's worked for me because they've been linked to podcasting, but I suspect it would work just as well if it wasn't for a podcast, if it was just like a book club. A book club is the exact same kind of thing, and it motivates you to make sure you read that book because, 2 weeks from Sunday, we're going to get together and discuss the book. So I better have it read by then. So making like almost an artificial deadline, just like imposing it, not just on yourself. Because if I just said, oh, I'm going to have this game played within 30 days, I simply won't. I'm way too, my laziness can overwhelm any deadline. But an obligation to a buddy is more motivating to me than like a self-imposed deadline. So like even a super artificially imposed deadline, like a book club, like a podcast, like a whatever, that says, hey, let's do a fun thing and let's get together and discuss it or finish it, or let's do it together. And let's do a knitting club, and every 3 weeks we get together and knit. That motivates you to actually get some knitting done because there's a group with which to do it. So to at least that extent, I'm a social creature. Podcasting is the thing around which I've gathered this, but I think it would work with any sort of club or any sort of buddy system. So that's worked well for me.
Wow. Awesome. And, you know, it also has the advantage that, it kind of encourages relationships with folks in the community, which is always
a
good thing.
One downside, right? One downside, you have to have relationships. If you could find a way without this, when we are all brains in jars or whatever, if I can build my robot pal who's fun to be with, then I'm leaving you all.
All right. Well, noted for future reference. So I guess we'll lose you when strong AI comes, but for now we've got you.
So. It doesn't have to be that strong. Vaguely weak AI, maybe like alphabet soup that happens to spell a couple of words. I'd leave you guys for much less than strong AI.
Monkeys with typewriters.
Back to the show.
Well, Paul, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was thinking that, sort of along those same lines, the events like Kansas Fest and like the Retro Challenge, sort of serve that function as well. That, the Retro Challenge is just a time when everybody says they're going to do something. 75% of them get like through the first week, but it still gets things started. For me, I think I'm still trying to figure out how to handle this. I don't have any success story to relate because I haven't succeeded, but I have that same feeling that Carrington mentioned, where it's sort of like there's just so many things that it is really, generally speaking, that I have a sort of a practical first thing, which is like figure out a way to make a space. usually that involves putting all the things that are in the space in a box that I will someday later look at. So I have a lot of boxes. Beyond that, I was thinking that perhaps I should use this as an opportunity to try to apply the kind of like general project management tools to this domain as well. That's the kind of thing you try to do for like your work stuff. You have a little list of things you need to do and some sort of like to-do management. But I've never really done that to any real extent with my retro things. But
that's a really interesting idea to take that approach. I hadn't thought of that before. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, because that's, if you follow the, whatever it is, what is GTD, getting things done philosophy, where at least a large part of that is just that your mind is cluttered by all these things that you're trying to remember. And it seems like more than it is because you're trying to remember it all the time. But if you can put it in some trusted spot where you can just say, something else is going to remember this for me, I can just focus on the thing that's in front of me. And then you can make a list and do things in order. And when you have free time, you can just see what's next on the list. That sounds very nice. It's kind of hard to keep in real life. It's actually a little hard to keep that going because, you know, there are actual time demands and things. And I haven't been super successful in my actual life doing that. But with the sort of reduced deadlines and demands and things, except for like maybe your disks are rotting or something, but otherwise, in your retro projects, that could work better even. So maybe I should do that. Interesting.
Hmm.
What do you do, Roel?
Very cool ideas. Well, I don't think I've quite got my head wrapped around this either, but I think one of the things that I need to do, which is a prerequisite, which ironically I'm also having trouble getting around to, is to reduce the complexity of my collection. I'm kind of, seeing the wisdom of Carrington's ways here in terms of minimalism.
It's a phrase that doesn't get used much. The wisdom of what now?
No, I actually, you know, I've thought a lot about the fact that you pare down your collection, Carrington. You kind of focus on some, you know, limited subset of things. And I think doing that, eliminates some of the free-floating anxiety. But I think maybe I found one possible way among many to have some fun with this, and that's let other people tell you what to do. And so I'm going to defer some more of my answer until we get into the news section, because at that point I want to talk about a particular blog that I've been looking at and really enjoying what they've done there and how that could affect what I do with retro computing stuff. So on to the listener feedback. Paul, you are the undisputed royal monarch of listener feedback. May I turn it over to you?
Sure. I will gladly accept that title. Actually, no. I will accept that title.
Well, you must, because it's a lifetime appointment.
Right. Okay, so the first thing I wanted to mention was that Quinn wrote over email. Last time we talked about Rocky's Boots, I think it was last time, and we made no mention of the sequel, which was the best thing that the Learning Company ever made, according to her, Robot Odyssey 1. She wrote that they took the digital logic concept of Rocky's Boots and extended to building robot internals to solve puzzles in a huge open world. And she says it's an astonishing piece of educational software that she's never seen the parallel for, and noted that they put a 1 at the end of it, guaranteeing that there would never be any more in the series. But so apparently this has a kind of a cult following, and Quinn herself wrote a tribute game for the PC and Mac called Gate, and there'll be a link in the show notes to get to this, but it's a similar kind of... You sort of build circuits with sensors and rock and thrusters to drive a little robot around and try to make it land on a sort of escape square in a terrain that has little mountains and stuff on it. It's pretty fun, actually. I spent a little while playing it, and so it's old enough that it doesn't run automatically on current Mac OS X, but you can start it from the terminal, and it's pretty cool. I had a lot of fun playing that game, and then there's actually Robot Odyssey 1 is emulated. It looks like the Apple II version, emulated online at robotodyssey.online. So I played that for a little while, and it's not the same game as Gate at all, but it is. It's quite something. Are you guys familiar with the game?
I am not.
Yeah, I am vaguely. In fact, when we talked about Rocky's Boots, I think in my mind at some point was it even on this show? At some point, relatively recently, somebody or I mentioned Rocky's Boots. For some reason, I keep saying Rocky Boots. And I think my intention was to mention Robot Odyssey. But having no real experience with either of these, I probably stumbled around and didn't mention it. So I'm aware of both, but I have barely touched either. In fact, I think at least one of the two I haven't played at all. They were definitely not part of my childhood. I didn't do them as educational games. I probably could still learn from them now, so they're probably still educational games from my standpoint. But all I hear is good things, and so they are on my list of many, many, many things that I would like to do. Coincidentally, these two have long been on that list.
I might well have been just confusing the two when I was talking about them before, because I too didn't really know them before, but looking a little bit at Robot Odyssey now, since last episode, that does look familiar. You sort of you go inside a robot and you can drive the robots around. You can connect the thrusters to the sensors and you put logic in there and stuff. It really does look quite difficult. And I know we did. I mentioned this link when we talked about it before, but I don't think I put it in there. There's a link from Slate, an article called "The Hardest Computer Game of All Time." Subtitled said, it was called Robot Odyssey and it took me 13 years to finish it and sealed my fate as a programmer.
Nice.
And it sort of just goes through this, but it is quite something. So I played the game long enough to basically get through the sort of tutorial levels and then it was time to do something else. But so we apologize for not mentioning that. It really actually looks like something that could be fun to play, you know, in retirement even.
I'm going to have a great retirement. The sooner I start that, the better for everybody.
Let's see. So Ben wrote to mention that just in connection to the playing games in 1,000 years, to sort of mention the situation of quite possibly those people in the future could be looking at software or games or whatever in a quite decontextualized way, too. So it may well be that the game itself gets separated from the documentation or, you know, whatever, reviews and stuff. And he noted that that's actually the way a lot of us remember these things appearing in, you know, in the actual time they were out, because, you know, you would get these discs from whatever gray market means you would, and there would be like three file games on a disc, you know, no documentation. The instructions were replaced by somebody, you know, cracked by X. And, you know, you just sort of puzzle around trying to figure this out. So there's also that aspect to think about in the future, that it may the software, particularly the software of that time, there wasn't actually that much online documentation, like on disk documentation, because the disk didn't have much space. So
that's a good point.
I remember Chivalry. Do you guys know Chivalry? It's an Apple II game. And I sort of remember playing it vaguely, and I remember thinking it was kind of fun. I remember also later being rather surprised to find out that it's a board game. like when you buy it, there's a board and pieces, and you run them around. And I guess that was sort of like it was somehow implicit in the gameplay, but I was still surprised to see that.
Yep. So I was very unaware of the packaging of the vast majority of games I played as a child.
Yeah. We're sorry, but you know, we were kids, right? Okay, and then Tony wrote about, I had mentioned, I guess, we were talking about preserving sounds and things, and there was an interview that I had kind of half-remembered with the person who made the Mac startup sound, and had also been responsible for the camera sound on the phone applications and things. And Tony wrote to remind us of a couple of places that Jim Reeks, who did this stuff, was interviewed. So the place I came across at first, I think, was on the Welcome to Macintosh podcast. But I think actually, and so there's episode 13, it's called Let It Beep. And that was the story of the Sosumi beep and so forth. It's very interesting. Also, I think there was a little mention of, or like a little portion of an interview with him in the Welcome to Macintosh movie, which I think is unrelated to the Welcome to Macintosh podcast. And there's a really interesting, like almost hour-long interview that we'll have a link to. It was in 1995, I think it was for some, it might have been for some Dutch publication or something. At least it appears that the interviewer is a native speaker of Dutch. But anyway, that interview I thought was very good. So it's possible we've linked to these things before, but we were reminded that we should remind you of them. So I have now done that.
And we are not actually charged by the hyperlink. So
that's true.
We can do it again.
So we got an email a little while ago from Mackay, there are a couple of things that he wanted to note. One of them was that the retro challenge is complete. He helped with some of the commenting and judging. I didn't look too carefully actually through the projects, but one of the things that his project was to put together I think it was for a Vic 20. It was for a Commodore 64, but it was basically putting together a demo cartridge. So he was trying to write software that you could put in on a cartridge that you could stick in one of these Commodore machines that would sit in a window and sort of serve as an attract mode for people passing by a museum. And I think he got most of the way done. I think most of the hardware stuff had been figured out and the software wasn't quite, some of the art was done. It's an interesting thing to look at if you have a chance to go read the Retro Challenge blog results. But he was actually sort of pointing out in his email to us that the demos and things from the demo scene and stuff are actually a pretty good way to demonstrate what a computer can do. If you're only going to have a couple of minutes with the machine, if you're just sort of trying to show what it is, that's one kind of useful thing that the demo scene provided was how far can you push this machine? What can it do? And that's slightly easier than just trying to pick some random game that, maybe some people have nostalgia for or whatever. So I think I sort of hit most of the points that he had in his email, but I thought that was kind of interesting. And I think we can leave it at that for the feedback.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah. Retro Challenge. I really enjoyed this time around. Basically, I had a goal and some stretch goals. My goal was get a 6502 core running on an FPGA, and I actually did that and made it run a program and was able to look at memory and determine that, wow, my program actually worked. But I didn't get any farther than that. I mean, I kind of wanted to have some way to do I/O with the program so that you could do something actually halfway useful with it or something, and I didn't quite get to that point, but again, it's one of those things where, like you were saying, Paul, Retro Challenge, it's an activity that is time limited and you have a stated goal, and so it makes you do something, it kind of gives you some encouragement to do something, so it's a lot of fun. And kudos, by the way, to the people who run the Retro Challenge and judge it and do all that stuff. They make a lot of fun for a lot of people. So let's go to the news. Carrington, you have an article that asks the question, how many computers are in your computer? I'm going to answer 3 because the Commodore 128 has, basically the equivalent of 3 computers in it. And that's my computer. So how many computers are in your computer?
Millions, I win. No, this actually comes from something that Blake Patterson tweeted out. It's a link to an article, kind of an essay on a website by somebody named Vern Bronwyn, who I'm not aware of really. And I'm always really concerned about linking to somebody's blog or essay collection because maybe they'll turn out to be a total monster. But it doesn't right. seem to be. I took a look through. Looks like it's an independent researcher, interested in psychology and stuff. And talks a lot or writes about things to do with the long now, which we've talked about recently, the long now foundation, this idea of looking over frameworks of 10,000 years and such. So it was right in the wheelhouse of things we've talked about recently. And what Blake tweeted was a link not just to an article, but to an appendix of an article, which I found very interesting. It's like, wow, why would somebody link to an appendix of an article? The article itself is interesting, and it's entitled Surprisingly Turing Complete. Now, Turing completeness, probably most of our listeners know, but it's just the idea of a thing is Turing complete if it could basically compute a program. So any program, even a super simple program, if you could give it some sort of input, it would be able to compute a program and maybe give some output. That's it. Super, super simple definition of what is Turing completeness. And this article is about things that are surprisingly, they are Turing complete. And it's stuff as wide ranging as obviously a lot of programming languages, but things like music notation is Turing complete. A lot of things you wouldn't think would be Turing complete are Turing complete. CSS, the markup stuff for graphics within HTML, that is Turing complete. So a lot of stuff is that you might not think.
Magic the Gathering.
Exactly, Magic the Gathering. A lot of things, you'd be very surprised. So the article is interesting, but there's an appendix to this article that is longer than the article itself. And I like that in an appendix. I like an appendix that will stand up and go, you know what? That I'm going to let you finish, but... And so the appendix itself is entitled, How Many Computers Are in Your Computer? And this is the idea of talking about AI, and if it begins with the idea of like hard AI, and like we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, or maybe before we started recording. Don't know when this recording started, but at some point today we were talking about hard AI. And like, how big would a computer need to house an AI or a neural net? But it discussed the idea that a lot of computers nowadays aren't just a computer. They're a big cluster of computers. Nobody's really concerned with, as the article says, like, how many computers is Google running on? It's tons of different mainframes, which themselves are comprised of multiple computers. Like, everything's basically a big gray glob of things that compute nowadays. Like, what even is a computer? So this begins with that premise and then just talks about things that you would be like surprised are actually not like a single thing. It's a bunch of computers. So when you look at a modern watch or a modern computer or a modern keyboard or a modern refrigerator or a modern whatever, look at all these things that are inside it that are themselves computers. In the same way that one can be surprised at things in the world that are Turing complete, you can be surprised that an individual thing is a computer, and you can be surprised that something you think of as one computer is actually a whole bunch of computers all together. In the same way that you think of a person, we're an individual entity, but there's lots of things like that live inside us that are also alive. So it was a very interesting article, and I think it has a retro element to it, in not just related to the things we've been talking about, but a lot of times we've had discussions about what makes a computer retro. That's come up as a host topic a few times in the years we've been doing this show. And normally we talk about it defined by like dates. If something is 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 200 years old, whatever, that makes it a computer, or a certain type of form factor, or can or cannot get on the internet, or is pre a certain date. Do you consider before Mosaic exists, it's retro, or whatever. Lots of very arbitrary things. But it occurred to me that another way to look at that would be a standalone computer, like the idea that a computer that's just that. It's not a collection of a whole bunch of things. There was an earlier time in computing where the computer in front of you would be just a computer, and that the modern idea of a computer, you're never going to go buy a modern laptop that is has just one processing unit anymore. So it's always collections. So another concept of retro would be a retro computer is a computer that is simply a single computer, not a bunch of them acting together. So I found that a fascinating idea that had never occurred to me before. But mostly I wanted to draw attention to this because Blake tweeted out, he's somebody you should follow on Twitter. He often sends out links to very interesting stuff. And I liked this article. I particularly like the big appendix to the article, and both the article and the appendix hold a bunch of fascinating notions that I think would be of interest to our listeners. And so I am, paying it forward from Blake, from Blake to the world, and from me saying, yeah, Blake does neat things. So that's what I'm contributing to this.
Cool.
And I'm hoping that I haven't linked to the blog of a monster. I don't think I have.
It seems like at least this article is non-monstrous.
I've always been fascinated by the stuff in the article about things that are or are not Turing complete, and like things that could I'm surprised, for instance, that certain countries that will elect to high political office people who are not Turing complete. Looking at you guys, but
yeah. I was thinking a little bit about the defining a retro computer in terms of being just a one computing unit, and even there, things that are in that range. I mean, like, so for example, the Commodore disk drive, right, has its own brain, one version of the Apple II 3.5-inch drive. You know, they have 6502s in them. Right. So are they?
Good point. So how much further back do we go before something's beyond right. Banging rocks together, I guess? I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Atari, the 400 and 800 had a graphics processor in it that had its own language. You would make, I think they called them display lists, and program that into the chip. And that in concert with the CPU and another couple of chips is what would form your display. I don't know if it was Turing complete, but it was definitely a processor chip that was chewing on some things all on its own. So I think even some of the original computers might not have just one Turing complete chip in them. I would. You might have to go back a ways. You might have to go back to,
I think,
like,
anything beyond TTL stuff is modern.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is tricky. I don't know what to think about the display-less processing. You know, if you can't, there's something sort of similar on the Apple II disk controller as well. You know, there's a little state processor that runs on that sort of independently and twice as fast as the main processor, and you can't, you, I don't think you can program it to do arbitrary things. But actually, I mean, like, I don't think the bar to being Turing complete is not that high, is it? I don't know.
No, because they say, like, in the x86 assembler, the single instruction move, MOV, is itself Turing complete. So, like, yeah, the bar is very low to be Turing complete.
Fascinating. Well, cool. I want to
read... Anyway, good article.
Yeah.
Good article and good, very, very interesting appendix to it.
I want to read that whole thing, including the appendix. Maybe I'll start with the appendix. Ooh.
Would that work backwards?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're a rebel. You're a rebel, Earl.
So I want to talk about another blog that I think is not crazy. you know, I kind of have this... picture in my head of your Atari 800 sitting there, and it's just taunting you, right? It's like High Noon at OK Corral. You're like, what am I going to do? I have some spare time now, but I don't know exactly what to do, you know, hearkening back to the host topic. So I have a solution for you if you're in that situation, and that's atariprojects.org. So this is a great site with lots of articles for short, fun projects for old Atari stuff. But, you know, like I mentioned here in the notes, sometimes you want to have some casual fun with the retro computer. You're not up for a 100-hour project. You just want to do a 30-minute project. You want to do something that's fun, like one and done, and then walk away and, hey, that was great. This site is for you. So I love it. I love that they've got tons of different things on there that cover a wide variety of topics. Like, you want to program something, you want to play a game, you want to read a book, you want to watch a video, some Computer Chronicles episodes that had to do with Atari. They've got a link for some of those on there. So this is what you want to do when you want to hug your Atari today.
Yeah, I like it. So it's similar to a list of, like, here are some projects I did, you know, and write-ups, like a somewhat common kind of thing that at least people aspire to do. But instead, this is a list of, like, quite possibly projects that have been done by the blog author, but without the details. It's like, you know, here's the thing that would be fun to do.
Right. Well, I mean, if you click on the details of any of those projects, what you'll find is a really nice write-up, kind of a step-by-step, almost like an Instructables or something like that. So the thing that I liked about it is you got the summary, hey, go do this. And then you've got a time estimate. This will take you 15 to 30 minutes. And then you click on it and you drill down. It's like, okay, A, B, C, D, E, here's how you do the thing. So it's instructional, but it's kind of interactive in that you're not just reading about something. The idea is you're going to read this stuff, but then you're going to go do it, or you're going to read it as you do it, or whatever. So I just really liked it. I liked the format. I liked the approach. And I like the fact that if you're just kind of spinning around for an idea, like, you know, I got a few minutes, I got my Atari computer, I got this blog, it's all good.
And I noticed that one of the longest things, the tied for the longest thing, is to read Kevin Savitz's book, 3 to 6 hours.
Yes. It takes a little while to read a book. Aside from Kevin's book, I think there might be one other book on there, mm-hmm, on Atari.
Breakout, yeah.
Yeah. So really neat. Okay. So having thus spoken, I'll throw it over to you, Paul. And I don't even have any clue what your next news item is about. So I can't make a nice segue. Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. So I came across this. I believe it was probably posted to, like, the CC Tech or Talk or, you know, some mailing list. But it's a web page called, let's see, and it was last updated in July. So it's called Things Every Hacker Once Knew by Eric S. Raymond. And it's basically just sort of a list of things, you know, just it's actually quite a long list of like some stuff from the past that, you know, computer people of today, you know, who are sort of brought up in today's environment might not know. So what's up with RS-232? You know, what were Gopher and FTP bitmapped displays? The stuff about, you know, the special characters in ASCII, in the ASCII character set and things like this that I feel like I learned maybe a little bit, but I was reminded of many things as I was reading through it. And it's not fluffy. It seems like the kind of list that you could imagine being kind of either fluffy or condescending or something like that. But I think it's actually kind of a nice bit of history, and it's a digestible size too. So it's something you could, you know, email to the useful hackers that you know.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, I'd find with, you know, my son's more of a modern day techie, but occasionally I'll find myself spouting off some kind of obscure reference, like even something like RS-232. I mean, nobody does anything with that anymore. Mm. And so he, you know, looks at me cross-eyed and I'm like, oh, yeah. Let me CD dot dot hold it, explain what the heck I'm talking about. So very cool.
Yeah, like why do you communicate? Why do you tell your Wi-Fi thing? Why do you start a command with it with AT? You know, what's that?
Right.
You know, but
so Eric Raymond, he's the Cathedral and the Bazaar guy, right? The one who wrote that kind of very well known work on open source.
I do not know.
I think he is. I think it's the same way. In fact, CATB, the website that this is on, I think stands for Cathedral and the Bazaar.
That does appear to be, yeah. I can fairly confidently say that you are correct. It is that person.
Very cool.
But so should I read that? I don't know. I actually don't know this work at all.
Well, check it on Wikipedia. I mean, it's getting a little dated at this point, you know, 1999. But I think it's kind of interesting in that it gives you some insight into like the open source development world from the days when the internet was really taking off and when Linux was really taking off.
Cool. All right. I didn't expect to find something more to read, but that's all.
Sorry about that. I gave you another project. Carrington, you've just got a lot of letters all run together on your next news thing. So over to you.
Which is one of my comments I was going to make. So there was an interesting quick overview. I'm calling it a review, but a quick overview in Call Apple, which is call-a.p.p.l.e. Difficult to type. And so they do a quick overview of something called the KBOO-HKW drive. So Call Apple was like, you think we're difficult? Look at this product. So it's spelled capital K, lowercase B-O-O, capital H, capital K, space, capital W, capital D, small R-I-V-E. It is a floppy disk emulator for the Apple II. And you couldn't possibly have a worse name for it. But it looks interesting and it works well. And the Call Apple review begins by lamenting that there are fewer and fewer options available for floppy disk emulating hardware like SD readers out there. And I thought, well, that doesn't feel right. It feels like there's tons of them. Aren't there like a surfeit of these things? But I guess while tons have been made, they, like most things, kind of stop being made. And so a lot of the ones that immediately came to mind, I guess I'm like, oh, well, yeah, I guess you can't actually buy those anymore. And so, well, many have come, many have also gone. And so a new one has arisen. And what separates this from some of the ones in the past is its embracing of the .waz file. So this is something that you, a little box that takes an SD card, and on that SD card, you can place .waz files, which are disk images for the Apple II. You connect this to an actual Apple II, and bingo, you've got yourself an emulated floppy disk, and the Apple II assumes that it's an actual floppy disk. This one has a little built-in LCD screen, so you can navigate through a bunch of WAS files on the SD card. And so it's just another option. It was one I wasn't aware of, and so it's neat to say, hey, here's another one that exists. I think it's currently for sale. It's like $70, so you can go online right now and buy one. So if you were looking for something like that and you can't find one of the other ones because the one you were most interested in, say, isn't available at the moment, then here's another option. I think it's really interesting that it embraces the WAS file. It's kind of weird that it can't handle .dsk files, which is kind of the standard I have mostly used prior to the .was file, but it would handle other sorts of file formats. And the person or people, I guess, that are making this, I don't know how to pronounce it, but the kbookkwooddrive. And perhaps if you pronounce that backwards, it makes sense. But it they have an online tool at their website that will convert .dsk files to .was files. So if you don't have another way to do that, then this can be like a self-contained solution for you. You download a bunch of .dsk files. You can use the provided file changer from this company, and then you can put your .was files or just download .was files directly and stick them on this, and then you can play them on your Apple too. So it's just another little piece of hardware, $70. It exists now. How long it will exist, who knows, because these things do come and go. Comes with a little 3D printed case, so it's got a nice little white look to it, I guess. And it's just a thing that exists that I didn't know existed.
That looks pretty cool. Yeah, I'd seen some discussion of it, but I haven't, up until, you know, probably an hour from now, ordered one. But I think this is probably the first thing to support WAS files, which
is the first one of these that I know. Yeah.
Yeah. And these, so those are the Flux files that, they're not exactly, they're slightly abstracted from that, but the applesauce, you know, Flux Imager makes them, or the software that comes with the Flux Imager makes them. And so what this can do in principle is boot a protected floppy, which is pretty wild.
Right.
So in that review, that did say something about like booting Wavy Navy and things like that,
right.
Which I know
was clearly mentioned as like, I'm like, I know why you picked that one.
Yeah. Cause it's, yeah, right. It's well protected. Interestingly, when I look on the site itself, the sales site, it says that it can't yet support quarter tracks, which is, so you could manipulate the Apple II disk drive in such a way that you could get not only tracks, but half tracks. And the weirdest thing of all, you could get between half tracks and full tracks. So there were quarter tracks, which you actually accomplished by turning on two different magnets to pull the motor into like the position that in between where those two magnets, you know, so they're both pulling on it. So it lands in the center. It's crazy. But at any rate, apparently the K-Book doesn't actually support quarter tracks yet, but is promised to. So that would be kind of crucial in getting some of the protections to work.
Right. And in the community, I think a lot of us are seeing the .was file as like, that's the file format going forward. That's the file format of the future. So it'd be nice to have like an SD card, like a floppy emulator that can work with those. My preferred little floppy emulator, the SD Floppy 2, does not. So I've been using it for SD cards, but like, you know, going forward, I would prefer to switch something that can support the .was file format. So I was happy to see that this exists, and it for $70, I think and that includes the 3D case. It includes the LC, like it includes the cable. Like for $69 US, you get a complete package: a 3D case, the cable, the LCD screen, the SD card reader, the whole thing. Like you've got everything you need except the SD little disc itself, and then the .was files you would download. But so I like it. At least I think I like it. I don't actually have it, so I wouldn't wholeheartedly recommend it yet, but I'm almost certain after we record, I'm going to be purchasing one.
Right.
Well, I don't know what to do about this, unobtainium thing where projects come and go, other than just to keep some money in your piggy bank. And if you see something you want, buy it now. I guess that's, you know, sadly, that's probably the way to do it, because so many of these things just pop up and then vanish. And I wish there was a way of doing something about that, but I just don't think the retro community has the economies of scale to keep some of these projects on the market indefinitely, right? We've talked about that. Wasn't that even a host topic once on the show?
Yeah, or maybe repeatedly.
Yeah.
But one potential way to get around that is to make the design more available. Like if one person is just getting burnt out, make it more hand-offable.
Well,
but everybody, but it's a fun project to design, so everybody wants to do their own.
Well, I think open source hardware, you know, definitely helps with this. Although, you know, a lot of people don't have the chops to actually buy all the components and solder it all together. But there's a better chance, though, that something's going to continue to be available if the plans are out there on how to build it. That's absolutely true. So In terms of figuring out how many numbers there are, I have a posting that I saw on Atari Age that I found really interesting. The question was, how big is the Atari 8-bit community? So this was a discussion thread on Atari Age. It had some interesting approaches that people took to try and make educated guesses on how many there were. And, you know, I think it fell between 500 and a million, and with probably the main guesses being in the several thousand range. And the conversation had some interesting tangents, too. So we'll have a link in the show notes. I thought it was just an interesting read. It's just three pages of comments at the moment, but I thought the different mathematical ways people were using to try and figure this out, like how many members do we have of this forum? How many of this particular extremely popular device have been purchased, which lets us know there's at least that many people out there, maybe, except for the fact that sometimes people buy more than one, depending on what. I think, you know, like the CFFA cards in the Apple world, I think when those would do run, sometimes people would buy more than one because they had more than one Apple II computer and they wanted to make sure you could get it while you could. So people had different approaches. And then, you know, they didn't talk about this, but I started to wonder, how do you even count if somebody's a member of the Atari 8-bit community? Is it like they play with the computer once a year? Or they're actively cranking out code or playing games, or, you know, how do you define it? And then based on how you define it, obviously the number would go up or down. But anyway, you guys might enjoy reading this. I thought it was interesting. It made me also wonder, in a more general sense, how many people there are in the active retro computer community at large. I mean, you count all the things like the Atari, the Spectrum, the Commodore, the Apple, you know, all the other ones. Like, how many retro computing enthusiasts are out there these days if you stuck them all in one big pot?
And I'm to assume that other people are real. just
yes.
Checking.
Yes.
For purposes of this calculation.
Right.
Okay.
They're not NPCs. They're actual, you know, real participants. So, you know, like a couple data points I can think of, I know it's at least 1,000. Because if I look at our Facebook group for Retro Computing Roundtable, it's got 1,051 members. So.
And you think people on Facebook are also real?
Well...
Interesting.
Well, let me put it this way. I doubt there's a bunch of people in the RCR Facebook group trying to do things like, I don't know, influence elections or something like that. I doubt that's where they'd spend their time. So, yeah, I'm...
That's how they get you.
So there's 80, 90% of them are real, I think. So, you know, there's probably... there's at least 1,000 retro computer enthusiasts out there. And... Yeah, like I would venture to say, you know, worldwide, it's got to be maybe more than 10,000 people if you lump all the communities together. Would you guys say? I mean, just wild, wild guess.
I would say vastly more than that.
Yeah.
More like in the 50 to 100,000 range.
Interesting.
Yeah, it seems not unreasonable. I really have no good way to estimate, but yeah.
Well, another thing that they were...
It's up to 50,000 or more.
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah.
Covering my
Very
bases.
Well done. That Venn diagram looks remarkably like everything.
If it turns
everything.
Out to be 50,000 exactly, you know, then just, you know, we'll hire a hitman.
We'll have a call. It's time for the retro purge.
Well, one of the things that they mentioned in the article and, you know, in this discussion thread, and I think it's true, even in the days of the internet and where it's trivial to just jump onto a discussion forum or something, there's still a lot of people who are just doing retro computer things, but they are just they're on their own little island. I mean, they'll look at the internet for project ideas or for specifications or booklets or whatever, but, you know, they're just off running around on their own, and we'll never know about them because they're not listening to the podcast, they're not interacting, but they're having fun with retro computers. So I think there's actually quite a few people who would fall into that category. So I think I'm with you, Carrington. I think that the numbers are up
there. I fell
into
that category for quite some time. When I got back into the Apple II and got back into retro computing, I was completely on my own, totally isolated from any broader community of the Apple II or retro computing in general. I was fascinated with the idea of going to Kansas Fest. There weren't podcasts at the time, but I listened to, well, there were podcasts, but not about retro computers that I knew of. And but I would read the online sites, I would read blogs. It was really interesting. I started a podcast, like 1 MHz, and that was it. And it was only. And other podcasts came out and were talking about, hey, I think we're the first Apple II podcast. I'm like, oh, over here, I exist. I was just meekly raised my hand. I've been doing it for a while now. Like, it's just nobody actually listens to my show. I was completely like that for ages and kind of really underestimated how giving and how welcoming retro computer people are as a whole. There are some total dillweeds out there, of course, but for the most part, it is a loving, embracing, wonderful, open community, and just was great and just kind of like welcomed me in and said, yeah, come down to Kansas Fest, we'll hang out with you, and it's super fun and it was just amazing. Like, I've made so many great friends because of the community. But when I started, for quite some time, it was just me tinkering with an Apple II, relearning and replaying and remembering games, and like completely in isolation. Like, I would not have been counted in any survey or any census of retro computer enthusiasts. And I think probably the majority of people out there who are interested in this stuff are consuming it or doing stuff, but are not making podcasts and aren't like going on forums and doing a bunch of stuff. They're just occasionally playing a game and they're interested in it. And I would suspect that's the majority of people.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of them. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Up to 50,000 or more. Like I said,
well, and particularly if you consider people who are emulating, you know, who are willing to just like do a little bit on their computer occasionally and not you know, buy floppy, you know, like SD card
right.
Floppy solutions and stuff.
Yeah, like, who don't want to put in all the stupid effort of doing all that? Like, oh, they're just like, I just want to play Load Runner or Jumpman. Like, you people are weird in your commitment to this. And I think most people just want to, like, go to, like, that's why the archive.org solution is so good. Like, they just want to go to a webpage, click on an icon, and play a game. And then when they're done with it and they want to go back to the real world and have real friends or whatever the heck that means, then they do that. And we sit in our cold, lonely homes soldering.
Oh, well, you make it sound so attractive, Carrington.
It is not.
All right. Well, yeah. Totally in with you on a couple of the points that you just made. Like, one is the welcoming nature of the retro computer community. Absolutely, totally, 110% agree. Come on in, the water is fine. It is just a great group of people. And the second thing I want to say is I loved 1 MHz. I actually wish someday there would be another episode of 1 MHz because that was one of my faves.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. But see, and so this is why you do things with a co-host.
Ah, yes.
Oh, right.
I think it's time for you to close us out, Paul. And this is so innovative. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is another thing. I guess all of my topics came from just like reading the mailing lists. But this was announced on the I forget what it's called, but the TRS-80 Model 100 mailing list. And it's basically a spreadsheet it's Audio Software Archive, and the title of it is Sonore, I don't know, computer audio. And it's basically just a bunch of worksheets that have links to WAV files of things that you can load in, you know, as if they were playing off a cassette into your TRS-80 Model 100. And the individual tabs are grouped into games and utilities and text, programming, education, telecom. There's and each one has quite a lot of stuff listed in them with the WAV files, with a very short, you know, like a one line thing that kind of says like what does this do. The intention is, so it's in Google Sheets. So the intention is that you could get to this with your cell phone as well, so that you can, you know, if you have a cell phone that still has a audio jack, then you can you know, browse to it on your phone and then plug it straight into your Model 100 and
I did.
Load things up.
I did. Oh, I did this.
Ah, cool.
Yeah.
I was thinking I would try and then I didn't, but so it works.
Yeah. Yeah. It's awesome.
Cool. Yeah. So there's something that this reminds me a little bit of something which I should remember the name of, but I'm now blanking on it. It's an Apple II cassette, like audio library. Carrington, do you know what this is?
I was just trying to think of what it was. It's driving me crazy. I was hoping nobody would remember. Yeah. Nobody asked me before I could remember what it was. Oh, it's something we've talked about a bunch of times. I'm sure I have bookmarked.
It is Apple II disk server. Does that sound right?
Sure.
Which does seem like a weird name for it, now that I say that out loud. But this might be it. But anyway, there's a similar kind of thing. A link will be in the show notes. And maybe I can, dub in somebody saying the name of it or something. But it's a similar
kind of
thing.
I'll just say all the letters of the alphabet now, and then you can just use that for future shows, and I don't have to actually show up.
Well, I think for
everybody wins.
Well, we'll need the phonemes. We'll need all the phonemes.
Yeah, for the navigation things, I think I heard Stephen Fry talking about this at one point, that essentially they would bring you into the studio, and then you would have to say a whole bunch of this sort of like nonsense stuff, in order to get all of the phonemes and all of the correct context, so they could reconstruct some
virtual Carrington.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what we need.
Software automated Carrington.
But anyway, yeah, so I think the Apple II has the ability to load things in over the cassette port. And that is, of course, the standard way you load things on the Model 100, right? Well, actually, there is a disk for that, too,
well,
though.
Well, there is. So, I was going to say, the Model 100, you've got, virtual disk drives you can put on your Android device and hook it up with a USB on-the-go cable and a USB to RS-232 converter. It all is a little complicated. If you're a Model 100 aficionado, it's not that bad, but there's a lot of Model 100s still out there. I mean, these things were really popular in a lot of niche applications, and your simplest scenario is you've got a Model 100 and you've got a cassette cable, and you just want to load in some software. That's the beauty of the simplicity of this solution that you've mentioned here, Paul, is that you don't need very much. The barrier to entry is really low to get a bunch of programs on your Model 100. I think this is just the best thing since sliced bread. I'm so excited about it.
And it's nicely organized. I mean, so you can find things. I mean, there isn't that much stuff out there for the Model 100, at least of the sort of general nature like this.
Right.
So,
just so we jump in front of people email, I guess, I think the thing I had in mind was the Apple game server. There's also the Apple disk server, which is the one we just talked about. Same host, same sort of idea. The disk server sends up a bunch of floppies. The game server was the original one that I knew about, which is a whole bunch of games, and then you just click on online WAV files or whatever, and it will play them. So that was the one I was originally thinking of. So we'll have a link to both in the show notes.
Right.
And with that, here's a word from our sponsor.
If you had a Honeywell automated office, it would eat up paperwork and increase secretarial efficiency. It sends messages faster than Concord and talks to other computers anywhere. Your business could be much more productive with office automation when it's designed well, built well, Honeywell.
Doctor, the universe is about to end.
What?
We need the orbital coordinates of 900 planets of the constellation of Castorberus in 17 seconds.
17 seconds?
16.
Constellation of Castorberus in how many seconds?
11.
Good interaction so far. 900 planets?
10.
Excellent response.
Come on, Doctor.
900 planets in how many seconds?
3.
3 seconds?
1 second, Doctor.
1 second?
Well done, Prime.
Prime computer.
Not so loud.
Prime computer.
That's better.
And we're back. And it's time to talk about buying things. We're coming up on the holiday season, folks. And I don't know about you guys, I got a Christmas list. And I'll tell you what is now on my Christmas list is the DigiRule 2. Now, I guess I'm just feeling impressionable today because, a minute ago I said that WAV file library was the best thing since sliced bread. But no, this ruler is the best thing since sliced bread. This is, you know, it's a ruler, which I think I've said like five times now, but it's also a programmable 8-bit digital computer that has buttons and LEDs like the old Altair, and you can enter programs in binary, and then you can run said programs, or I think even single step said programs. And it's got some really neat features too, like the fact that you can change the speed of the processor that's running the program. So if you want something to kind of step through a little bit more slowly, you could see your program actually running in real time. And it uses, I think, a PIC microcontroller as its brain with a custom program that makes it quasi-emulate. I don't even know if it's acting like any particular 8-bit chip specifically, or if it's just kind of a generic 8-bit processor of the developer's own design. But this is just one of the best things I've seen in forever, and it's so cheap. It's I think it's $16, isn't it? So anyway, I'll stop talking so you guys can talk.
Well, it could slice bread, so
that's true.
It's got, it is long and thin, knife kind of shaped. I think this looks like the most difficult to use calculator in the history of calculation, and I'm including just piles of rocks and rough estimations. So on the left side, there are 8 buttons where you enter your bytes in binary, 1 byte at a time, and you get a spreadsheet as well that you can use to like enter your instructions mnemonically, and then it'll give you the machine binary code that you can, like, oh my gosh. Like, the time it would take me to add up anything in this is remarkable.
Well, now, bear in mind, it's not supposed to be a calculator. It's supposed to be a programmable computer. It would be kind of like doing your general ledger on your Altair using the front switches. I think that would be the...
Right, see, I had an Altair as a kid, and not being like a nostalgia thing, being like, hey, one of the first quote-unquote computers I had, I just remember the frustration of thinking, but... this isn't a computer. I've seen computers. They speak to you, or they do things, or they play games. And this is just a bunch of switches and buttons that I don't understand it. And so I guess it's just I'm having flashbacks as I look at this Digirule 2. It's like, oh my goodness, this looks hard to work.
There's a little sort of like demo video that sort of shows how you program it, and the program, it's probably something like, I don't know, 10 instructions long or something like that. Where essentially what it does is it stores a value in the LED light up spot. So there's a display spot, and then sort of shifts the bit left, you know, repeatedly in loops. It's actually, you know, it doesn't take that long to put it in. The spreadsheet sort of assembles it for you in some way, you know, so you can sort of see what you want to toggle in. But, I don't know. It looks kind of fun. Unfortunately, I don't actually need a ruler for anything. So this would be pretty much just for programming on. But
this is one ruler to rule them all.
That's true.
And it is an actual ruler. Like on the bottom, as you point out, it does actually have like a little display in it. So you could actually physically use it to measure things out. So in that sense, it would be actually very useful and intuitive and easy to use as a ruler. Just a ruler with a whole bunch of electronics attached on the front of it and a CR2032 battery.
Right.
Yep, it's definitely for doing your checkbook.
So today I got my notification from Tindy saying my order has shipped.
Cool.
So maybe I can tell you about it next time.
Did you say balancing your checkbook?
Yeah, just kidding about that whole checkbook thing.
It is cool though. I mean, like, definitely watch the video. You might like it.
Yeah, I was making fun, but it's different and neat, and like for somebody like, especially for like $16 or whatever, this is a neat stocking stuffer, a neat toy for somebody who like does want a ruler. Like you're at your desk, let's say you need a ruler or a straight edge, and you use that quite a bit in your work. This is a fun, different sort of ruler that even if you just played around with it a bit and then didn't subsequently program, it's a neat-looking computer-related ruler. So I think in terms of a gift, like absolutely a fun, useful stocking stuffer type gift. So I think it's actually well chosen for the gift guide.
And I think that programming in anything other than binary is for wimps, but that's just me.
I should also point out that it's only an 8-inch ruler or 20 centimeters, so it's actually short for a ruler too. So it's not even a particularly good ruler. I just keep seeing things about this, and I'm like, I would have done that differently.
Oh, my. Maybe we should talk about other things to buy. Carrington, what have you got on eBay?
I got a thing that I hadn't seen before that I think we already established that Paul has at least some of because, you know, welcome to eBay. So what I found was a sealed or still sealed interface accessory function strip for the Apple II. So the idea of this is to add function buttons to your Apple II. So the Apple II just has its normal keyboard, but imagine if up above that on the lid of the Apple II, you had a bunch of stickers essentially that stuck down and that were function keys. And so how would you add those? Well, this has, as the box says, very easy installation. You basically just peel off and stick it down. But then when you read the back of the box, it shows how it's super easy to install. And step four talks about the soldering involved. I'm like, wow, okay. So step four is solder a male DE09P connector pad on the top side of the enhancer too. I'm like, wait, I got to do what now? So I think this is really cool. I've never seen one before. But Paul, I think you were saying that you actually have at least had one Apple II with this already applied?
Yeah. So I have one or two. I'm not sure. But I have not applied it, but I have received an Apple II from eBay auctions that has this on it. And so it has a little ribbon cable that goes, it's actually kind of annoying in a way because the way it's attached to the lid that normally comes off of the Apple II. But then there's ribbon cable that goes down and plugs into the keyboard underneath. And the soldering is if you're, you know, like you may need to attach the thing that it plugs into. Some have it, some don't. But if you need to add it, then you need to solder. But at any rate, that what it does is it makes this top that you normally can just like pop off and like look inside the machine. It connects it to the keyboard. So it's a, you know, like I worry about the ribbon cable when I open it and I have to sort of like flex it out of the way. But anyway, yeah. So I haven't tried it out, but I think these are basically just like macro keys.
Yeah, it seems like Vidtex, who made this, they made a thing called the Enhancer 2, which I guess did a bunch of macros, and then this becomes function keys that you could use, especially if you have a Vidtex Enhancer 2, then you can program little macros instead of now using key combinations, you would be able to just press like function 9 and it would execute it. So it's kind of cool. Like it's neat that it would do this. Mm-hmm. I don't know about how great it would be to have these, you know, stuck actually on the lid, but I hadn't actually encountered this before. So for me, it was new. And I was like, what the heck? This is 16 function keys that are programmable for the Apple II and they stick on? How neat. So it is available for the low price of $295. My goodness.
It's still sealed though.
But it's still sealed, so you can immediately open it up and make it worth less than that. Way to go, me. That's what I would do. Because, yeah. I mean, why have this if you're not going to stick it on? But if you want it, it's $300, 21 days left, so you can pick this up and stick things that are, like, stickers that work on your Apple II. I like the idea. I wouldn't buy it, but I like the idea.
Yeah, I think the company is, I've always pronounced it as Videx. It has no T in the middle, but...
what? No, it doesn't. I was thinking about that recently. In America, I guess a lot of you like football, and so there's some sort of quarterback or something. Football is, for the rest of the world, it's like ice hockey except without skates and puck and interesting parts. So football is this thing that Americans do, and I guess there's a really famous quarterback named Brett. You guys pronounce it Favre, even though it's like... It's Favre. It's like it's a French word, and the R and the V come in the opposite order. And I was like, what do you mean Favre? How weird. So I guess I just did the same thing. So
yes.
There you go. So it's Videx, not Vidtex. Okay, cool.
Yep.
Videx?
Yeah, you can't just add letters.
Sure, I can.
Right. Color favor. Oh, yeah, this company actually made a number of things that were sort of related to this. Like, I think they had, like, a lowercase adapter, and I think they also did, like, 80-column cards. But definitely things that had to do with video and keyboard things for a while. And they actually they went into the Macintosh era a little bit. They actually made a couple of games for the early Macs, and I think also made a calendar program or something for the Lisa. So they're sort of a like low level, like second tier well known company. Anyway, whatever. And I've seen but have never gotten my hands on the early Mac and Lisa software from them. But these are the the things I think of when I see that company.
Well, for me on eBay, I'll be quick. I've just got a couple of Commodore calculators, and I actually stole these listings from Paul, so thank you, Paul. And one is for a desktop calculator style, the other is for a pocket calculator. Both are look like they're LED calculators. Interestingly enough, one works and the other doesn't. One is insanely priced. That's the one that works. But at least it does have a make offer on there. The other is really, really nicely priced at just $15, the pocket calculator, but it doesn't have any evidence that it works. The listing says that they don't have the charger. So don't know what to say on that. I would love to have one as a part of my Commodore collection just to feel like the Commodore collection was somewhat complete. And both of these look like they're in nice shape. They both have the Chicken Lips logo on there, which, you know, for Commodore lovers is a plus. And, you know, you could buy either one of them. I don't think I would be shelling out $250 for any kind of calculator. And the other one, I would hesitate to click on the buy button because I'm just weird in that, I, it's not just a conversation piece for me. If I buy it, an old piece of technology, I'm interested in it actually working and, you know, poking around with it and seeing it do stuff like it did in the day. But, you know, you don't see these Commodore calculators as often as you used to on eBay. They still come up. They still come up pretty regularly, but the frequency has died way down. So, you know, maybe beggars can't be choosers. But these are good listings. And like I said, both of them look like they're in nice shape. So that's a plus.
Yeah, I have. So the listing that we're looking at here is for, what does it say? It's like a GL986, I think. Yeah, GL986R. And I have a GL987R. I have no idea what like distinguishes those two. But it does appear that I don't see a battery compartment in my photos of it. So I think it's quite possible that it really does need a power cord in order to turn on. And at that point, then it gets a little nerve-wracking because it's easy to pick like one that's the wrong polarity or whatever if it doesn't actually say on it what it needs. I find that super irritating with all these electronics that they, you know, forever they have always said, use only, you know, whatever Sears brand, you know, some arbitrary jumble of letters and numbers power adapter with this. They don't tell you what it is, and you've lost your power adapter.
Right. And they don't tell, like you say, they don't tell you what the polarity is. They don't tell you what the voltage is. That is kind of a bummer. I find that modern electronics actually with wall warts and that are better than older stuff used to be. And the other thing that would be a little nerve-wracking about buying it and hoping that it works is the NiCad battery in it may have long since given up the ghost.
Oh, you think it's rechargeable? Maybe. I guess it seems like it should be.
Yeah, a pocket one I would think would probably be rechargeable. So.
Yes, I see. The label on the back of mine says solid-state portable rechargeable electronic calculator. So
gotcha.
Maybe I should open mine.
Right, before it starts getting bigger, like my MacBook was.
Right.
So on eBay, what have you got for us, Paul? Oh, you've got some more microprocessor trainers, don't you?
Paul has the rest of eBay for us.
Yes. I love these trainers. Just quit tempting me with these microprocessor trainers.
Yeah, so I have the first listing here is the Heathkit. That's interesting.
See, these are a step up, Carrington. At least they're not just binary. You know, you've got hexadecimal that you can type in on these.
I love CPU trainers. I love these things. I love them in all forms, and they are gorgeous to me.
Yeah, no, I have a soft spot for these as well, although I have not used them yet. That's another project I need to do. But I have one of these that I program. Well, let me see what it is. It's a Heathkit. It's an ET3400, it's kind of stalled off there for a second because the listing doesn't say that anywhere. It says EIA 416. I don't know where they got that number, but it's an ET3400. But you know, so you've probably seen these before. It's kind of like a blue plastic box that has a numeric keypad on the right, some some sort of sectioned off areas where there's a set of LED, like seven segment LEDs, and chips and a breadboard and some other LEDs. And so it started really low. I mean, right now the current bid is $10.50. And if you just look at the picture, then you just see a trainer. It's like, all right, well, you know, I've seen many of these. They're all, you know, they're cool, but they're fairly readily available. But if you continue on, it's actually sitting on top of a memory I/O accessory, the EWA-3400. And I'm not exactly sure what the difference is between an EWA-3400 and an ETA-3400, but at any rate, these are memory accessories that are themselves relatively rare. So that's the thing that is of interest in this particularly, is that it gives you, like, I'm not sure exactly how much memory, but it does give you extra memory. It gives you tape in and out.
Interesting.
So it's a pretty useful thing. And the, I think one of the last pictures shows that it works. So it's, when you turn it on, the first thing it does is puts on the LED's CPU up. And so when you're looking at these, if you see that, you know that at least it gets to that point. And I mean, it's not a super sophisticated thing, but the thing about these is that at least some proportion of them were built by, you know, amateurs who got a kit and soldered it themselves. So who knows if it's going to work, right? the price on this is definitely worth, it's worth what it started at for sure. I mean, I expect it's going to go higher, but I was pretty impressed. And I kind of wanted to point it out just because if you are just looking at the cover photo, you wouldn't notice that it had this desirable memory thing as well. So now are you tempted?
Yeah, even more so, actually. Thanks a lot.
Sure. They're not too big. I mean, yeah, it doesn't take up too much space.
That's true.
You can put That's it how they get you.
Yep. Okay, the next thing I have, somebody's bid on this as well, is a Sears Telegames system. So it's the Atari 2600 clone, I guess, licensed alternative that Sears made called the Telegames. And it is it's one of the early ones. So it's a heavy sixer, they are called. It has six switches on the front, and it's the heavier frame. Has lots of controllers, has two paddles, two tennis paddles, and two like regular 2600 joysticks. And it's got the box. And I think that's the thing that kind of drew me to it, is that it's complete and it has the box. It's a heavy sixer, so it's collectible. It's pretty cool.
There's a bid for $10. This is going to go more than that. I'll just predict.
Almost certainly, yes. This is my favorite old, like, if I was going to have a 2600 in any format, it is this particular one. I prefer the Telegames ones. It's the exact same thing. Like, it plays all the same games, same way. I just have a soft spot for old Sears stuff and for Sears in general. And this would be the one that I would want to have. I don't actually want one because Atari games have kind of lost their, like, this era of Atari games have lost their luster for me. I love the old arcade games. I love later era Atari games. But, like, the 2600 games, this offers, you know, minutes of enjoyment playing.
Right.
There's a couple of games that are really good, to be honest, but most of the time I'd rather just have an emulator for these things. But if I was going to own one of these, this is the one. This is the sweetest of all of them. I just adore it. The physical, actual, like, the actual console, I think, is just beautiful, and I love the Sears logo on it. I love everything about it. So
yeah.
Or the Sears logo, the Telegames thing. So just adore it.
And I don't think I'd ever seen the box before. I mean, it's got tape on it or whatever, but I mean, it still is the box. So
yeah, I've never seen the box for this either.
It's the same seller actually as the previous one too, the trainer. So I don't know. I think there was a selling as is, yeah, as found in an estate sale. I think as found at a local estate.
Yeah, and it's a big thing, and it's like $16 shipping or whatever. So it's good.
All right. The next thing I have, I thought it was just interesting. It's a $4,500 buy it now, so it's only interesting, you know.
I'm in.
Yeah, but it is a fairly large lot of Exidy Sorcerer-related stuff. So it looks like there are two machines, and what appear to me to be three I actually don't know enough about the X80 Sorcerer to know what I'm looking at. If there are like three spare motherboards or if these are parts for an external expansion thing. There's a bunch of tapes. There's a bunch of manuals, a couple of expansion cards, blueprints, and discs. It's one of the... Looking at the back of the Sorcerers, I think that those three boards are actually three spare motherboards or logic boards
and
or whatever they're called.
Different eras of logic board, too, yeah. Because they're different than each other. One is very different than the other two, and then even the two that look the same are slightly different. So I guess different eras, different models. I don't know. I don't know a lot about the Sorcerer.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, so it would be interesting. I would kind of hope that if one were to... go in, you know, like actually buy this, you would get a little bit of information on where it came from. Let's see. I was told these were in-house units used for production testing and engineering. Interesting. Former Exidy employee. This is this gets more interesting as you read the description. So this actually, it's not just somebody had a couple of Exidies. This is actually possibly like test units from the company.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Texidies.
Yes, Exidy. I've always been sort of mildly interested in getting one of these, but never at the prices that I see them. And you know, they're taking up space and stuff. But
I really only know it because it's come up in past RCRs when we've talked about it, and I know it in that context. But it wasn't something I was even remotely aware of. Like back when it was out, and I've never had one. I've never had hands on one. Yeah, and it was an S100 thing, right? In my mind, I have lumped it in as one of the S100 computers.
Yeah,
which, another reason why I wouldn't know it very well.
Well, I don't know. Let's count the pins. That looks about right.
Anyway, it's a big lot. Yeah, it's a big lot of stuff: extra boards, yeah. Tapes, discs. No. Cartridges. Didn't the Exidy have a cartridge slot on the side? I misread. Oh, no, there are a couple of cartridges there, too. Okay, just either face down or without labels. Whole bunch of stuff here.
Yeah.
Extra proms or EPROMs. It's a lot of things. Big jumble of stuff.
Those cartridges are 8-tracks, though. I mean, did the Exidy actually... It looks like... And actually, it looks like the loose boards are from the inside of such cartridges. No. No, I guess they're too big. No, they're right.
Who knows? The only way to know, Paul, is for you to purchase it.
That's interesting. See, this is the problem with having so much stuff, is that, like, I think it would be fun to just, like, have this as a project and, like, work on this for 6 months and, like, figure out all the stuff that there is in this lot and what it was used for and what it does and that kind of thing.
If only we all lived forever.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Yeah, why did I have to be made out of meat?
Well... Pretty soon.
Excellent.
Do I still have more? So the one other one I had was a reasonably priced TRS-80 Model 200. So it's a step above the Model 100. It has a much larger screen. It looks like it's in pretty good shape. Actually, it looks like it's in quite good shape.
Yeah, it looks brand new. It doesn't show it running, unfortunately, but it looks great. I mean, the battery compartment's clean. Like it looks like it was purchased and put away. It looks like nobody's ever touched it.
Yeah, and it didn't yellow either. I don't understand why this one didn't yellow. The description says the battery compartment is in good shape, and when I plugged it in, the system lines appeared. When I plugged it in, the system. What? Anyway, the point is, when it was plugged in, lines appeared and then disappeared on the screen. This, I think, is actually relatively standard behavior for these things if they have been unplugged for a long time, because there is a internal battery that needs to be charged in some way, which is also a concern. But from what I understand about these, if you leave them plugged in overnight, then you have a better chance of having them start in the morning.
So that's like here in Canada when we have to plug trucks in winter. Right. Okay, got it.
Earl, does that sound familiar to you?
Well, I've never actually worked with a Tandy 200 at all. So I don't know.
I have some number of 200s and 600s, and they all do the same thing. You know, like you start it up, and it's just like static, basically, on the screen. Like, you know, the things are lit, but it's not doing anything. I've heard that if I left it plugged in, it would help, but I haven't actually. I should do that. Maybe I should do that tonight. Anyway, but right now it's the current bid is like 3350 on this, and that's pretty reasonable. So they're mildly rare. Obviously, the 100s and 102s are much more common. The 200 is pretty common-ish, and the 600 is not very common. The 600 is like the 200. Oh, well, okay, let me back up. The 200 is sort of like a laptop, so it has a screen that flips up, and then many more lines than the 100 had. And then the 600 is like the 200, so it also flips up, but it has a 3.5-inch drive built in. Okay, are we done with that? I think we are. Okay, so my last link, I don't know if this is interesting. It might well not be interesting, but it is a link to, well, the first one is a link to an Earthlink mail station Mevo 100, which is like an email machine. It's an email appliance from, I think it's like 1999 or something like that. It's sometimes sort of late retro, right? So the idea was that you would get one of these things and, you know, do your email with it. Not anything else particularly. It would be in conjunction with an Earthlink account. So you would, you know, dial in and then you'd use this. And there were a few models of these. So the second one I had is a mail station 150, which is like one step more developed. And I think there were a couple more after that. Of course, the place that you would use to call, you know, like they don't do anything anymore. Like there's no Earthlink to call. And in fact, actually you can buy these on Amazon, and you can read the comments on the ones that you can buy from Amazon complaining about how there's no Earthlink anymore. How dare you sell these?
I bought this and how can I email with it?
Right. You know, I saw these listings and I thought, well, what is this thing? I don't know what this is. I'm kind of curious. And I looked around, and there have been some attempts to hack them and, you know, sort of do things with them. So there's, in particular, there's a site, fibertech.net, where there's some documentation of some stuff that's been done with them to try to, like, make a usable operating system and just try to, like, reverse engineer how the thing works. And there's an emulator there. But it's based on a Z80 computer. It's an 8-bit Z80 compatible CPU in there. So you could, and in fact, somewhere here there's like a screenshot of like, part of the attempt was to run something like CPM on it. And somewhere there's in, I think running in the emulator is like CPM Zork. So I thought that's kind of interesting. You know, even though it's not usable as mail, it might be kind of cool as a little like Zork machine.
I was really interested in the fact that it had a Z80 in it and what you could possibly do with that. So I think if you could get one super cheap, and if there's even a small community around trying to hack it and make it do things, I thought having a tiny little computer with, you know, that's not all that terribly old with a Z80 might be fun.
Yeah, it seems like it. But it also does seem like there was kind of like a wave of interest around like 10 years ago, and it's fizzled pretty much since about like 2010. So there's a mailing list or a Yahoo groups list on which people, you know, discuss this. And I don't see anything from 2018. There appear to be 18 posts, 17 posts from 2017. So, but who knows, maybe this is the catalyst, this very episode, to restarting the community.
You're launching a movement.
Yes, that's right.
That's a phrase that means something else, actually, but okay.
Perfect.
So I have the perfect link. So in looking at these Mevo things that I had never heard of before, they reminded me of, there's a standalone thing that you can type on that I think can connect to an Apple 2GS, and it just was, the form factor of this was bugging me. So I started Googling around, what are these Mevo things? And I found the greatest link that we've ever put for RCR. So this should be the only show notes anybody ever goes to. So there's a article from Forbes from 2001, August 29th, 2001, on a terrible website. Like you go to this page, it's going to just pop open everything. All the ads they've had since 2001 will attempt to run. But once you get past all that, It is the only 8 gadgets you'll need. So this is what somebody in August 2001 thought, a college student going off to university. They say it's so confusing now, and the people have laptops, and they got to do all these things and high-tech stuff, and here's what you actually need to bring to college. Forget everything else. Not on this list, of course, is a computer, mm-hmm. but on this list is things like a Rio line of MP3 players and a cordless phone, a George Foreman grill, an alarm yep. clock that can silly blue, clearly influenced by late 90s Macintosh, that kind of weird translucent blue, one of those. It's an alarm clock that can set itself 6 times a day. You'll need a GPS. Basically, this is somebody saying the iPhone doesn't exist. You need all of these gadgets plus a grill is what you will need. It's hilarious. On this is one of these Mevo things, so you should definitely get that. Uh-huh. Like, oh, this is the greatest gadget list in the history of everything. I love this. We should have this person on the show and discuss this list to go. So would you like to change any of your opinions?
Yeah.
This list is wonderful. So you need a Mevo 350, George Foreman grill, a Rio MP3 player, a Palm device.
I have two of those four.
Glorious.
So I have the George Foreman grill, and I have an old handspring visor.
I think this list is still accurate. These are actually literally the only 8 gadgets you need in your life.
So things you need. I agree.
Especially the George Foreman grill. I love that made it on a gadget list.
Well, sometimes my iPhone gets kind of hot, you know.
But can you cook a chicken on it?
Wow, this is perfect.
Yep, it's a delightful list. So there you go. Thank you, Mevo, for introducing me to this whole world that I did not know about.
So anything else we should buy?
I think that was all I had.
All right, we've spent all our money, so let's go to closing discussions. I'll start with me. I got nothing. Paul, what have you got?
I have nothing in particular except that one note I had mentioned, just because it seemed like newsworthy, but not items of interest worthy, is that there was the MIT, what is it, CSA, Computer Science AI Lab Twitter account tweeted out. They have a sort of running like this day in tech or something like that. And today, as we record, is when Mosaic 1.0 was released 25 years ago. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
That was that web thing, right?
Yeah, NCSA, right? Mosaic, yeah.
Yeah, I knew that was a fad from the very beginning. And, you know, glad to be vindicated finally.
The SSID of my web access point here at my house is actually the web is a fad, and it has to be forever.
That's cool.
Yeah. So if you live near me in Toronto, you will now know that, because if you ever look up and see the web is a fad, you're proximate to my home.
Right.
So you guys, knock on the door, come in. We'll do retro stuff.
Know what to hack. Well, what have you got to close us out, Carrington? Land this plane, would you?
Abe Books. I've had this Abe Books saga going on in my life for the last while. I think we've talked about it on the last couple of shows. It's so weird. My demographic, you know, straight white, cisgendered, middle class male, I drive me crazy. I am so much a problem in my life. So there's this thing going on, and I think I've talked about it a bit on the last couple of episodes, where how does one pronounce Abe Books, A-B-E-B-O-O-K-S, Abby Books, A-B-E Books, Abe Books, whatever. And so I gotta be a couple months ago, 6 weeks ago, or whatever, went on the website, and there was a video hosted with somebody pronouncing it Abe Books, and I figured, done, that's it. Then I mentioned that to a local person who kind of dug in and said, it says that, but that's just a video on the site. That doesn't mean it's canonical. Maybe that's just like a hosted thing. It doesn't mean that that's really what it says. And so, and this is what I think I mentioned in the last episode, I actually picked up the phone and called the company, and it turns out they're in Canada, and talked to them, and they said, yep, it's Abe, like the name, Abe Books, abebooks.com. That's what it is. That's how it's pronounced. Said that to my friend, and it's an interesting thing that I've never thought it's bad to mispronounce a word, because that usually, and so this was somebody else's idea, I either heard this or read this something years ago, it just means you learn the word by reading, and that's a good thing. So I had a friend once in high school who pronounced the character from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as Zaphod Beeblebrox instead of Zaphod, and I had said, I think it's Zaphod, and they said, well, no, it's the way it's spelled, it's clearly Zaphod. I said, well, but it's the book is just a basically a version of the radio program that came first, and I've heard that, and it's SafeOn, and I've heard the author actually speak. It's like an audiobook version, and there's a television show. Like, there's a lot of evidence here that I'm correct about the pronunciation of the name. Dug their heels in, saying, well, no, clearly from the way it's spelled, it's Zaphod, and they just dug in and refused to change. It's a weird thing that tech people, particularly tech people like me, seem to do. It's a whole GIF versus GIF thing. You dig, you read it, you pronounced it one way, and it doesn't matter what evidence you get about how it should be, you just dig your heels in and you just make up rules and say, nope, it stands for graphics, and so therefore it's a hard G, and I don't ask me how I pronounce NASA and whatever. So I have a person in my life digging their heels in, and it's not a hill I'm really willing to die on, but it's weird that I cannot convince this person that it's pronounced A-Books. They have now come back with my evidence of having phoned the company that maybe the person I talked to is either a new hire or doesn't know how it's pronounced, or they're just that's not – just because they pronounce it that way, just because that's how originally it was pronounced doesn't mean that's how it should be pronounced. And they've now started to make up all these rules, how if you look at how it is, there is no English word where you'd be able to say like – Abe Books because of that caesura, that little pause. And I'm like, bookkeeper. Dude, there's lots of words where you it's difficult to pronounce it. That's just how it is. And I cannot convince this person that it's pronounced Abe Books. And they just dig their heels in more and more. It's a weird thing happening. And it just makes me think of the GIF versus GIF thing. And like so many times in my life where just somebody says, I refuse to accept your evidence. This is how it is. And it's bizarre. So I got that going on. I just want to bring the listeners up to date to that. I'm still saying it's A-Books, and there is no amount of evidence that will convince some people that words are pronounced certain ways.
If only they had like TV commercials or something.
Like, it's so weird. It's so weird. So I got that going on. That's kind of it. But I got that. Oh, I went to a horse show this week. My girlfriend, she lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her. Bingo. we go to this thing called the Royal Agricultural Winter Fair, which as a city boy is not a thing I ever anticipated I would go to. But the last bunch of years, we go there a few times. It goes on for a week and a half or something. We go two or three times. Sometimes it's black tie. So weirdly, she gets in a gown. I get in a tux. And we sit in the stands and watch people jump horses over things. I don't understand some of the things that are in my life now, but such is the way of courtship, I guess. So I did that.
It's expanding horizons, I think.
Okay, sure.
Or finding out that you're allergic to creatures that you didn't know you were allergic to. That's another
one.
It's
also
to look
a world
at.
I don't understand in the way that like I will have really strong opinions about operating systems or keyboards or things that really, let's face it, don't matter. And she'll have very strong opinions about what is a particularly pretty horse. And I'll be like, how do you have a pretty horse? They all look like horses. I can't tell these apart, but apparently there's horses that are more attractive than other horses. Like, that's a really nice one. I'm like, but it looks like all the other ones and they all kind of smell the same. Like when you're not discerning about something, it's remarkable to me how like I literally can't tell these things apart. Why, what makes one a good horse and not another one, a less good horse? I have no idea.
Yeah. Totally with you. I have friends who are really into wine. And, you know, from my perspective, if it's more than my taste tops out at $20 a bottle. Like, if it's more than that, it could be the $1,000 wine or the $1 million wine. I'd be like, yeah, it tastes like wine. You know?
Yeah, to me, wine is just, it's juice that hurts. Like, it's like, oh, why does this grape juice burn me? I don't understand.
Yeah, it is interesting how like expertise can really like change your perception like that. I have the same kind of experience as well with like computers and to me they're all very distinct, you know. But like all shoes look alike. So, I don't know. Yeah.
They cover your feet.
Totally with you. I like the things I don't know about. Yeah, I hard to tell apart. Cars, a lot of clothing, yeah. Like things I don't have the interest in and therefore don't have any knowledge. I do acknowledge that there are differences. Like clearly there are cars that are much better than other cars for whatever reason, and I'm just not into cars, so it's more difficult for me to tell them apart. But I don't like dismiss the idea that people with more knowledge than me, like I don't dismiss the idea that there are distinctly horses that are prettier or better or whatever than other horses. I'm not discerning. I can't tell them apart, but I can tell you minute differences between a bunch of Apple IIs and why I have strong opinions about some versus others. So you know what you know, or according to Dunning-Kruger effect, maybe I know a lot less than I think.
I think you probably know a lot more than you think, and you're learning more. That's the good news. You're getting out there, and you know, you're finding out about.
So I want to be out there. I like to be in here. Here's computers. There is cold and people.
It's warm in here. It's cold out there. Yeah.
I suppose pretty soon there will be a Carrington-hosted Beautiful Horses podcast, right?
Absolutely. Somebody will invite me. Boy, man, I am a sucker for being somebody's co-host. You want to do a podcast, you need a co-host, you just ask me. I'm like, okay, I'm in. Who's going to say no? But yes, I will no doubt soon be hosting a What Makes Horses Pretty podcast. I'm like, I'm out of my depth here, man, which is usually my feeling on most podcasts I'm on. So it's totally fine.
All right. Well, I don't know how to segue into the final closing then, but I'm going to do it anyway. So that's it for this show. You can find show notes for all rocker shows at rockerpodcast.com. Wait a minute. RCR, we pronounce that rocker, right?
Right. That's the way I always read it.
That's the way I've always said it. Let me do that again, just in case
I have strong opinions about retro computer roundtable and which are the actual words and which are the things that should be capitalized.
Right. Is it one word?
That is a host topic discussion one time.
Yeah, is it one word or two words?
So maybe it's the RR podcast.
Well, because retro computing can be one word or it could be two words. I've seen it both ways. Round table can be one word or two words.
Can open worms everywhere.
Yes, RCPRT.
So, but you know, I've been to the website for Retro Computing Roundtable, and so I can tell you exactly how it is, and you can't tell me it's any different.
That's right.
All right. So you can find the show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org. We'll have the link up in the show notes. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group. Be part of the community. There's 1,051 people, and we're looking for more all the time. You can find that at www.facebook.com/group/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. I'm seeing a theme here. And we are, I think, still a member of the Throwback Network. Are we not anymore?
We are, but it's now a static page.
We are, but it isn't.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, as far as I'm concerned, we paid our dues, so we're members. And please write a review on us on iTunes, and it helps other people find us, and it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy. And until next time,
Retro Compute. Rocker!